All right. The technology has decided to cooperate.
Oh, good.
How's the weather in here?
It's a little stuffy, yeah.
Okay, we can put on the fan.
Barry, are you in the corner?
I don't know if I'm contagious anymore. I've had this head cold for like 3 miserable days, so I don't want to.
Okay.
We appreciate it.
Okay.
Thank you.
Good morning. So we're going to listen to her first I thought we were just going to listen to 4 minutes, but we're actually going to listen to 9 minutes. She's telling the story about when she moves to Canada and her experience, and then she'll talk for the last 4 minutes will be about her writing and how she sees her writing. So without further ado, I yell at Sabari.
You see? My heart. I knew there were no Yemeni poets published in his time. He had no role models in his community to look after. So I moved to Canada at 25. And in Canada, I discovered that for Canadians, Jews meant delis and lox and matzo ball soups. Most people I met in Vancouver had never encountered a Yemeni Jew, knew nothing of Mizrahi traditions. I remember the local paper actually acknowledged Passover in an article. That was a big deal. It was such a small community that, you know, big holidays would go unnoticed. And I was thrilled to read the article. And the entire article was focusing on different preparations of matzo ball soups. And at that time in my life, I've never even had matzo ball soup. And you know, in my family, we eat Yemeni soup for Passover or spicy fish. People often ask me if I spoke Yiddish. They stared at me confused and actually said, "But you look like an Arab." So I explained, you know, my grandmother lived amongst Arabs in a small village by the Saudi border. She spoke Arabic and the Yemeni dialect and little Hebrew till the end of her days. And she wouldn't know matzo ball if it hit her in the face. Then when I started reading in English, I discovered that the portrayal of Jewish experience in English language books was even narrower than it was in Israel. There was never any Iraqi Jews or Tunisian or Ethiopian Jews. No wonder people in Canada were so confused by me. And then 10 years ago, I started to write in English. Trying to describe that switch from Hebrew to English is difficult because it wasn't really a definite moment, nor was it a clear decision. It sort of happened, and it happened gradually. When I first moved to Canada, I couldn't comprehend writing in English, in my second language. I didn't think my grammar and vocabulary were up to par. They weren't up to par. I found reading in English extremely frustrating. And at the same time, I struggled to write in Hebrew because I was no longer using it on a day-to-day basis. And it was before, you know, social media, so I didn't have that direct link to Israel like I do now. So I went through a few difficult years of not writing at all. At the time, I excused it as a writer's block. But I tell my students all the time that writer's block is basically fear. And I was terrified. I was terrified on taking on writing in a new language. I realized, looking back, that maybe it wasn't just a block, too. It was kind of a limbo. It's like the writer in me had to die a little bit in order to be reborn in a new language. And it was an excruciating and lengthy process. For a while, I wrote intermittently in both languages. They just sort of bled into each other. It was an incoherent mess. Nobody could make sense of it. My English was still not good enough, and it felt like it would never be good enough. But at the same time, I was also starting to feel enamored and excited about the newness of English. Samuel Beckett was asked in 1954 why he chose to write in his second language. He wrote in French. His answer, out of a need to be ill-equipped. And I realized reading that I needed to be ill-equipped because I thrive on challenges. It keeps me on my toes, it makes me humble. English for me, despite it being, you know, the most spoken language in the world, actually I don't even know if that's true. To me it felt like this secret language. Our lack of attachment, our lack of shared history allowed for this fresh affair to begin. It gave space for invention, for fantasy. And I found comfort in the anonymity that it afforded me. It was also an excellent exercise in constraint because I had to tell a story with fewer words. There is no question that I was a different writer in Hebrew. And I say was because I rarely write in Hebrew anymore, out of fear to jeopardize whatever it is that I've achieved in English. And when I read my Hebrew writing now, every so often I do, I recognize it in it, this richness of language that sometimes I worry that my English writing lacks. On good days, I see it as an advantage. You know, I think my writing is cleaner now. I was young when I was writing in Hebrew. You know, I think I enjoyed flaunting my vocabulary. But on bad days, I sometimes sort of ache for the ease of Hebrew. You know, it's the language that flowed in my mother's milk. There's nothing that can replace that. And I wonder if I'll ever be able to achieve that kind of ease and that kind of flow in English, or if I'll ever be able to reclaim it in Hebrew. And then there was the issue of writing about Israel. Being a new writer who just took on the, you know, the challenge of writing in a new language, for a long time I wanted nothing to do with that. Israel is such a loaded place that writing about it is bound to be perceived as political, no matter what you do and what you write about. And I just wasn't sure if I was ready for that responsibility. I was too scared to make people angry. I was scared to somehow get it wrong, as if there's only one way to represent the place and the people who live in it. So whenever I wrote about Israeli characters, they were generally outside of Israel and their nationality was incidental. But this nagging voice that just won't let me go told me, no, this is not what you're supposed to do. You need to write about Israel. And at the last minute, I gave in to that urge and decided to go for it. I was filled with such dread and such anxiety that I knew I must be on the right track. One of the quotes that really spoke to me during that time was by Cynthia Ozick.
Cynthia Ozick
said, "If we blow into the narrow end of the shofar, we will be heard far. But if we choose to be mankind rather than Jewish and blow into the wider part, we will not be heard at all." So I resigned myself to the fact that I'll probably, you know, piss some people off. I decided to commit to my own little brand of truth. I call it truth with a small t, rather than, you know, taking on the burden of representing an entire nation or a people. I was not interested in writing war stories. I'm not interested in writing about the conflict. I'm interested in mini conflicts. I'm interested in relationships and people's dynamics. But of course, in Israel, the political and the domestic are so tightly entwined, there is no separating the two. So I wanted to explore that sense of tension and contention that is threaded through everyday life in Israel, and how it affects people's relationships and people's dynamics. Often when I read news about other places in the world, other troubled places in the world, these are the stories I want to know. I immediately imagine, you know, people's daily lives amidst the tragedy and the terror and the war. I picture people falling in love and breaking up and sisters fighting over clothes. And I think that's what fiction does best. You know, while a reporter would be standing on a rooftop and there's the smoky city in the background and he'll be talking about people as a mess. Fiction zooms in on that one house, that one family, and that one voice. And by doing that, I think it helps create empathy and makes us see the other as less other.
So, just thoughts, and then I'll tell you about the segue to our story.
I think what you said about the English Hebrew is really reflected in the story we read, mm-hmm. right? Say it again, mm-hmm. say something else. There's tension there, right?
Yeah, right, yeah. Right, right. Yeah, just first of all, when she quoted Samuel Beckett, you know, I needed to be ill-equipped. Mm-hmm. You know, so much of her writing is about displacement and about being the other. And it seems that she needed to do that in the language as well, experience that otherness kind of with the language. And she, you know, she's able to write about it so beautifully. okay. So, and she also speaks about her Mizrahi identity, and I love that. My mother wouldn't know a matzo ball if it hit her in the face. That was great. wait a second. I'll get some water so I don't have to, like, croak at you. Hold on a second.
I thought she was describing my matzo balls.
They're that bad.
No.
I don't believe
I haven't
that.
Made them in years because we go to our kids, and so. Yeah.
He makes them.
Well, they make them with their kids.
Yeah, so. That's so nice.
The great debate of hard or soft matzo balls.
Oh, yes.
Soft ones.
The
golden
one.
Yeah.
The second. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Right. What are you drinking? Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Cute.
So, right. So her identity. So this is an issue, right? That Lily is clearly confronting as she comes to Israel. You know, what is her identity? Who is she in Israel? And the place that's mentioned, the part of Petah Tikva called Sha'aria. It's one of the neighborhoods where the Mizrahim were kind of put. Mm-hmm. At another time, maybe I'll show you. She shows some pictures of it in that talk. And, you know, it's like you imagine, you know, you saw in the movie Salah Shabbati, you know, where these are temporary camps. They're not quite mud houses, but they're not, you know, where people who establish themselves financially would live. So, you know, on the one hand, it's her place, that Sha'aria, and Lily's place too, but it's a very kind of poor neighborhood. all right, so let's go to it. Say it again, say something else. So, Wendy already... And can you say a little bit more about what you said about the tension between say it again, say something else?
I was wondering if, on the way over here, I was thinking about the title, say it again, say something else, are two different things, because when you say it again, it's a repeat. Say something else is new. And I'm just wondering if that's a reflection also of the two characters. One is a white Russian Jewish girl, and one is an Arab Jewish girl, and they're different. But say it again, say something else are two different things. They're not
yes.
the same thing.
Yes, yes. And when she, when Lana is saying it to Lily, actually, let's take a look at it. On page 35. So this is when their relationship is beginning to heat up. They're becoming best friends. So they, middle of the page, they hang out at Lily's place because it's always empty. Most days, they just watch TV. When they watch American shows, Lana asks Lily to repeat some of the lines in English and then laughs. You sound just like them. Actually, Lily says, our accents are different. But Lana just says, say it again, say something else. You've heard this conversation before. I think it happens with kids and when they first hear an English accent. You know, you say, could you say that again? Or like we used to do it with our cousins who lived in New York. We couldn't believe that coffee was coffee, you know, or something like that. You know, oh, say something else, you know, or say, you know, or people do it with Chicago people.
Right.
You know, Chicago, Chicago, roof, you know. We have all the words that you can tell the, you know, Boston, park your car, right? Lily is the one who understands our accents are different. The Americans don't actually speak like the Canadians do necessarily. A few less A's in the conversation and about, and you know, so there are things that you could recognize as a Canadian accent. But Lana is just wants to say, no, no, it's all one. And she says the same thing about Israeli identity too. And let's go back to that. We'll get to it. So go to the beginning on page 25. The day Lily meets Lana is her 2-week anniversary in Israel. So what do we got right here?
She just moved.
She is the outsider. She's just there. We have no idea why. Of course, we find out why. But the day that she meets Lana. So, you know, it sounds kind of hopeful. New kid in town, meet somebody. Great. She's lying on her belly in the dried out grass outside the apartment building she now calls home, watching insects through her macro lens. She's sweating in her faded jeans and Converse high tops. Then a shadow eclipses her sun. Ilana, can you continue?
You're new here, the girl says. Where did you come from? Lily squints up, ripped black stockings underneath an acid-washed jean miniskirt, a white sleeveless tank top, blonde hair and a high ponytail. Canada, Lily says.
Okay, so look at the description, right? You can totally imagine what Lana looks like, right? The blonde ponytail and the ripped stockings and so on. But this girl comes over to her, right? She's very, you know, remember that Lily is down there with her little glass or whatever. She's not looking. This girl makes the first move, which is wonderful. Okay.
Cool. We moved here from Belarus 2 years ago. I'm Lana. Lily looks up again, this time intrigued. She doesn't know where Belarus is.
So she's not intrigued. Yeah. What's she intrigued by? Never heard of Belarus before.
Yeah, yeah.
Lana, okay, well, maybe. Mm-hmm. Okay.
I live at entrance C. You live at B? Lily nods. She wonders if the girl is her age, if she'll be starting grade 9 in the fall, too, if she goes to the same school. Aren't you hot in those jeans, Lana says. Lily shrugs. You should cut them, make them into shorts. I don't wear shorts, Lily presses her eye against the viewfinder. A ladybug navigates her way through giant leaves. Can you take photos of me, Lana says. I need some portfolio shots for this modeling agency in Tel Aviv. Lily clicks the shutter. I'm not that kind of photographer. We can barter, Lana says. I can cut your hair for you. I'm good at it. Why do I need to cut my hair? You can't even see your face like that. She watches Lily. Do you have a boyfriend in Canada? Lily shakes her head. Lana shifts her balance from one foot to the other. Silvery, strappy sandals, chipped blue nail polish. Hey, a bunch of us are going to the beach tomorrow. Do you want to come? Lily raises herself onto her elbows. Really? I mean, sure. Cool, Lana turns away and walks away into the dark stairway that leads to entrance C.
Okay. So what do we now know about Lily and Lana?
Lana must have seen Lily before to know which entrance she was.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so she's right? You must be B, I'm C, right? Mm-hmm. Great, what else?
Well, the barter thing struck me, how it's, you know, It's not an even friendship because Lana's trying to make it an even friendship by evening everything out.
Which is what a wonderful thing to do, right? She's the veteran.
Right.
Lily is the new person, and yet she's saying, you know, we could have an exchange. Great. What else?
Lana's pretty, oh, I'm sorry.
I was going to say, Lana's covered head to toe. And Lily is strutting around.
You mean the other
Lily?
Yeah.
Yeah. Lily's right. covered. And Lana's strutting around in ripped stockings, a tank top, with a skirt, right. and strappy sandals.
Right.
With chipped blue nail polish.
Right. Right.
It gives us a very clear visual, doesn't it?
Doesn't it? Doesn't it? And of course, so Lily's just sort of dressed for Canada, right? Or still, you know, dressed Canadian, you know, whereas Lana, you know, she's dressed for warm weather. Great. What else about Lana particularly?
She's pretty extroverted.
Very extroverted.
Mm-hmm. And Lily's introverted.
Yeah. Lily's actually being rude to her, right? She's keeping her eye, this woman, this girl, I don't know what's going on here. This girl has gone out of her way to talk to her. And
she's still looking through the camera.
She's looking through the camera. You know, what kind of, but does Lana, it's, you know, I don't wear shorts. Lily presses her eye against the viewfinder. A ladybug navigates her way through giant leaves. But Lana doesn't even seem to notice. You know, right. She's not going to be deterred by, you know, that.
Lily's just, to me, just a pretty, you know, basic, 15-year-old, 14-year-old.
Yes.
I don't think it's rude. I think it's just
nonchalant kind
maybe
of thing.
Self-absorbed or something.
But part of Lana. Part of Lana wants Lily to conform and to cut her short and to become an instant Israeli.
Right, I can cut your hair, you know. Yeah, so she's, Lana is there ready to do the makeover whenever Lily says the word, right? So Lily's looking through the viewfinder. Lana just keeps going, take photos of me. I need some portfolio shots. You know, there's, you know, we can help each other. Lily clicks the shutter. I'm not that kind of photographer. We can barter, et cetera, et cetera. So when does she look up?
With the beach, when she invites her to come
when
to the beach.
When she says the beach, when she says the beach. She's, really? I mean, sure, you know, and maybe going to what Wendy was saying about kind of being, you know, a 15-year-old and being self-absorbed, you don't want to show too much enthusiasm, you know, you don't want to sort of let on in that. And great, so this seems to be Lily's lucky day. Somebody's already invited her in to go to the beach, and we learn that she loves the beach. Okay, so... Now, we're going to learn that Lily has a very close relationship with cameras. What is her relationship with cameras? I mean, it comes out here in this little exchange, too.
It's how she prefers to see the world, is through her through the camera lens. So it's something between her and the world.
And it allows her to think about what she's seen at a later date when she reviews the pictures, and she doesn't have to think about it at the time that it's happening. So it allows her to kind of separate where she is now and reflect on it without having to integrate that simultaneously.
Right, right.
And if you're overwhelmed, that makes sense. You know, you kind of take it in and think about it later.
And it also functions as a little bit of protection, right? Because when they do get in the car to go to the beach and she's been set up for this, you know, to be with Igor or whatever, yeah, you know, she immediately takes out the camera and starts, there's protection here. You know, let me create a barrier between you and me, so I...
It's like a cigarette used to be.
Yeah. So it helps her in a way. But also it is about the artist, the person who's documenting experience or interpreting experience as she goes along, and she can reflect on it later. Okay, so let's go to, the bottom of 26, we have the immigrant neighborhood. Connie, do you want to?
Up the stairwell to entrance B, Lily lives in a small apartment with her Aunt Ruthie and her cousin Talia, who is a soldier in the Army and only comes home on weekends. The apartment building, a long, tawny three-story and three entrances and rows of laundry strung between windows, is opposite a falafel stand that reeks of oil and chickpeas and garlic and cigarette smoke. At night, when the air is juicy and the street lamps paint everything a warm, forgiving color, men with beer bellies and women with henna's hair sit on their small balconies, crackling sunflower seeds and spitting the shells into the hibiscus bushes with their red trumpet flowers. Through the open windows of the buildings on the block, Lily can hear TVs blaring and dishes clanking, kids crying and couples fighting and having sex. Teenagers hang out on the metal barricades in front of the building, smoking cigarettes and laughing. Some evenings they bring down narghile pipes and set them on the sidewalk, and the smell of apple tobacco sweetens the air.
Right. So, okay. So, what is the neighborhood like? What's the feeling in the neighborhood?
It's very Israel.
It's very immigrant too.
Yeah, I was just gonna say not high.
So what happens in an immigrant neighborhood?
You bring the customs of wherever you came from.
Right. So the narghila pipes is you know right there.
But you can smell it. The smell.
And you can smell it. Smell. Right. Yeah. You can smell it. If falafel
you can feel
reeks.
And, yeah.
So there are a lot of different kinds of smells. And everybody knows everybody's business, you know, because everybody, it's the neighborhood. There's a closeness there. There's an intimacy there.
Lily and Ruthie are not on the same lower middle class.
Ruthie and Talia. Yeah.
They're like a misplaced family in comparison to what she's describing going on in the street.
Yes, and they certainly think of themselves.
They think that way.
You know, and that's the thing, because you have two sets of immigrants, right? You have the Russian Aliyah and you have the Mizrahi Jews. And the Mizrahis came before the second, you know, there were Russians coming, you know, but the real Russian Aliyah came when Russians came to this country too in the 90s. So the Mizrahim are the veterans. They're the, you know, the people who, the Russians are the new kids on the block. Lily is actually one of the veteran families.
Which means somebody's moved out of the block. Mm-hmm. And so the Mizrahis who are still there,
yes,
are the ones for whatever reasons, whether it's socioeconomic, whether it's grandma lives down the block, for whatever reasons they're still there.
Right. So but it is a mixed neighborhood.
Right.
You know, it's all different immigrants. But it's actually switched in terms of, you know, Lily is the new girl, but in a sense she has a higher status. If there's a pecking order between immigrants, and there often is, right? We had it here with the German Jews and the Eastern European Jews, right? It's okay. So cracking sunflower seeds, very Israeli. So, you know, some of them, but the beer bellies and the hennaed hair. We have a sense of what the community, what it's looking like. And at the end of the street, on the edge of Petah Tikva, which Lana later calls what? You know, a crap hole, or, you know, yeah. I can't wait to get out of here, and so on. But Lily likes to watch the airplanes. And now we, at the bottom of that second paragraph on 27, Lily imagines, she sees the airplanes and she imagines them, her grandmother, Saida, whom she remembers from previous visits, and her grandfather, Salim, who she's only seen in pictures, holding hands and mouthing prayers as the plane descends toward the Holy Land. So, so she sees those planes and she starts to think of her roots in this country. You know, she's been here. She's been here on a number of visits, and so. But this picture of her grandparents holding hands mm-hmm. and saying mm-hmm. prayers. Where does that come from?
The immigrants, right?
So it may be the story that they told her mm-hmm. about how, you know, when they
or
were coming
from
in.
Old pictures.
Right, and remember that Ethiopians and Mizrahi Jews, you know, they had this very, very romantic notion about what it meant to come back to the land of Israel before they met up with the reality of what Israel was like toward them. So on that plane, there's a lot of, you know, this is, Mashiach has come. We are going back to Israel.
On the wings of an eagle.
On the wings of an eagle.
The other thing I think is really interesting is that traditionally, neighborhoods by airports are really the worst neighborhoods.
Right.
But she frames it as being very positive.
Yeah.
So it's really kind of nice that it's this sort of flip of how you look at it.
Right. Airports are possibilities. People
right.
transitioning from one place to another. Back when her grandparents arrived, her mom told her, the whole neighborhood was Yemeni. Even now, with all the new immigrants, Russians and Ethiopians, when Lily walks down certain streets, she still sees old Yemeni ladies, just like her grandma, sitting on their front porches, in large dresses and flowery headscarves. These streets are fragrant with fenugreek and turmeric and coriander. And from the synagogue, she can hear men singing prayers in an undulating Yemeni accent she doesn't understand. This is where her mother was born, where she grew up and lived before she moved to Canada. Lily even looks the part, but she feels like a stranger, a tourist. So
it's the conflict of Sabari, really. Mm-hmm. It really is. On one level, she's very sophisticated. On another level, she's...
Right, when you come to a new country, even if it's the country that you've dreamed your whole life of coming to, on the one hand, you think, well, I should feel at home here. But you don't, because you haven't lived here. So it makes, you know, it totally makes sense, but it's a kind of dissonance or a paradox that she has to wrestle with. You know, I should feel homework. My mother was born here, but she feels like a stranger. After all, she's only been there for 2 weeks, right?
Right.
She is a stranger.
Well, and there's a difference between how you feel when you're visiting
yes.
and how you feel
yes.
when you've moved.
Mm-hmm. Yes,
this
right.
This is how it's going to be.
Right, mm-hmm. right. Okay, so skip to 29. Starting, she cried every night for the first week.
Okay. She cried every night for the first week, missing Vancouver, missing her life, missing her mom. It almost felt as if Ima was still alive, just back home in Vancouver. It reminded her of the only time she had been apart from her mother for an extended period, the one time she had visited her dad in Montreal. She only cries when she's alone in bed, because she has promised herself she won't cry in front of people. If she's going to make friends in a new school, then she can't be known as the crybaby, the sad girl. In her first year of junior high in Vancouver, she'd been picked on for her boyish clothing and her hair, for hiding behind a camera. She doesn't want to give bullies more reasons to torment her.
Okay. So what do we learn about Lily here? So cool the way she just sort of fills in the picture.
Mm-hmm. She's homesick.
She's just lost her mother mm-hmm. recently.
She's sad, she's lonely.
Yeah, she's been
she's
bullied.
She's sad, she's yeah. lonely. She's been bullied before. Yeah. She was not a social success no. back in Vancouver, even if she misses it.
And she's trying to be tough.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yes. Which is really extraordinary, you know, because depending on the personality of the child, you could be kicking and screaming for months. But she's only been there 2 weeks, and she's already strategizing. I am not going to be the crybaby. I am going to, you know, there's a saying, I'm going to plan this so that I am not bullied anymore, and that I'm, you know, not going to be the sad girl and so on, which is amazing. So in some sense, she's accepted
she's
what has happened.
She's laughing at the grinch twice over.
Yes, yeah. yes. But what do you mean by that one?
And she felt like an immigrant in Canada the first time. And she's actually making progress. She's not going to cry in front of people because she knows it doesn't work. It's not a good idea.
Right. Even in Canada, she was the daughter mm-hmm. of a Yemenite woman who had moved from Israel. Mm-hmm. So in a sense, she was an outsider there, too.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And she's also had the loss of her father as well as her
yes.
mother.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. Yes. Through divorce. And clearly, he did not elect to take custody of her, mm-hmm. which was...
There's also part of it which is around abandonment. So she's yes. now... This is all she has, mm-hmm.
right.
so she doesn't want to be thrown out of there. Then where is she? I mean, there were some relatives, I think, back in Canada, but none that would keep her. So there's that emotionality going on, too.
Right, right, right. So there's a survival instinct that's happening here, too.
Yeah.
And also, by placing her father in Montreal, she's placing him in another country with another language.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, it just felt so extreme to me that, you know, she really has very few choices. She knows English, she knows some Hebrew, but she probably doesn't know a whole lot of French. And, you know, this is a young woman without many choices.
But she probably, I mean, she's able to converse with Lana,
right.
with seemingly no trouble. So mm-hmm. she must have a fairly good command of Hebrew. She doesn't...
No, that's yeah, what I said. She
right.
knows Hebrew. She
right.
knows English.
Right.
French?
Yeah,
French.
French
in
yeah.
Montreal now?
Right.
Savary must be an incredible woman. I mean, to write in English.
I know. It's really
amazing.
Incredible. Your second language
uh-huh.
is something. But you can. But she said it was an excruciating process.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
She had to be reborn in a new language. That's so fascinating. But she also says it was an advantage because, you know, she had to tell the stories in a cleaner way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she's not at home in the English language.
But she had to reject her persona to some extent. I can't even do that.
Yeah, it is remarkable.
Mm-hmm.
So page 30, she's having some memories, right? The peace rally on Granville Street, Ima holding a big sign that says Jews for Peace. The last Thanksgiving at their house a few years, Ima had wanted to cook a turkey but didn't know how. I didn't grow up making it, she cried. And in the end, she drove to Hastings Street and donated the uncooked bird to an outreach place and made enchiladas instead, which had since become a tradition. The photo was entitled Thanking the Mexicans. So we learned about her mother.
Yeah.
I mean, how...
We probably also learned about the neighborhood they lived in.
In
Vancouver.
Yeah.
Right.
They lived in another immigrant neighborhood.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So, yes, right, but her mother, Jews for Peace,
right.
her
in
mother...
In Vancouver?
Yes. But she couldn't make a Thanksgiving. She couldn't make a Thanksgiving turkey. So there's those... You know, as she said, with the matzo ball soup and the Yemeni soup,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, so there's a lot of outsiderness.
But then
and
she made Mexican
yes,
dish
yes,
that
yes.
she had to learn because they didn't have Mexican.
Right.
right.
That
yeah,
wasn't
right.
like making, like she was saying, she makes a Yemeni dish.
Right.
But
right.
she did choose to do something different.
Right, right. So go to 31. So it looks like Lana's not coming. And then, 4 o'clock, okay? Wendy, do you want to read Lily Slides the Shutters?
Lily slides the shutters open along its track. It's late, she yells. Lana cups her hands over her large sunglasses. Oh, you haven't been waiting, have you? It's too hot in the day. We always go after 4, stay for sunset.
Okay, what's happened here?
It never occurred to her that they were going, they were going.
Right.
To the beach.
Everybody knows, but yes. She didn't know you go after 4 o'clock. Okay, so, and now she comes to the car, and Lily wiggles into the back seat next to Igor, who cocks his head and ogles her. Lily jerks her head so how do you like Israel? Igor says, his Russian accent heavy. It's okay. Lily wipes her clammy hands on the swimming trunks and pulls her camera out of her back.
Right.
Protection. Okay. Go to 33. Wendy, do you want to read a little bit more? I'm going to swim to the wave breakers.
I'm going to swim to the wave breakers, Lily says. You want to come? Lana eyes the string of rocks. Okay, she says, but if something happens, you'll have to save me. When they make it to the wave breakers, Lily climbs up first and gives Lana a hand. Wow, cool, Lana says. I've never been here before.
What's so familiar about that? It often takes the outsider to see your home, right? She's been here for a while. Mm-hmm. I mean, not so long, but a couple of years. And she's never swum to the breakers, somebody else who shows you something you didn't know about your own place. Okay, keep going.
They stand and watch the Tel Aviv shoreline, the scallop bays, the row of palm trees along the seawall, the beach cafes with their clumps of blue and green umbrellas, hotels with mirrored windows winking sunlight, and skyscrapers dipped in haze. Then the city descends into the smaller amber houses of old Yafo, easily concealed by a thumb, with a spire marking the city's southern edge. To the north, a line of boats clings to the marina. The sounds of the beach, paddle balls hitting rackets, children squealing, the ice cream man yelling, are muffled by the waves and the breeze. On the other side of the wave breakers, the sea is choppy and dark blue, and silhouettes of tiny boats are poised on the thin line between water and sky. I can't wait to be old enough to move here, Lana says. Petah Tikva is a shithole. Wait till you start school. Lily looks at Lana. You go to Brenner? Lana nods. The girls were so snobby when I first moved here. She bends down, digging out a handful of seashells and wet sand from between the rocks. Now I just don't care anymore. Fuck them. Yeah, Lily says, fuck them. Their eyes meet and both girls smile.
So what do we have here?
They're commiserating.
Yes, the immigrant solidarity.
Right.
Yes.
True outsiders.
Now I just don't care anymore.
Right.
Right. She doesn't care anymore. Right? But good, good. Okay, keep going.
It's hard starting in a new place. Lana throws a shell far into the sea, then another. In Belarus, my mother used to be a pharmacist. My father was an engineer. Now he works in security, and my mom cleans houses. It's pretty bad here. It's hard to find jobs. Lily looks down at the glistening rocks, the salt stinging her eyes. Lana stretches her arm back, then she hurls the remaining shells towards the beach. What about your parents? Lily feels a wet stone sliding down her throat. My mom is dead, she says. She'll never get used to saying that. She died 6 months ago. Lana puts her hand over her mouth. Oh my God, I'm sorry. And your dad? He has a new family, Lily says. I live with my aunt. Lana stares at Lily, then she leans over and hugs her, wet skin on wet skin. Lily almost loses her balance. When they get back to the shore, Igor and Sion are playing paddleball. We thought you drowned, Sion chortles. So you just went on playing. Lana rolls her eyes at Lily. Sion picks up Lana from behind and threatens to throw her back in the water. She squeals and laughs, kicking her legs in the air. When he puts her down, they kiss. Lily notices Igor is watching them too. Lana wrings out her hair and sits on her towel. She pulls the sunscreen out of her bag, but this time she hands it to Lily. Lily coats Lana's warm back with it, mimicking Sion's motions. When she's done, she grabs her camera and snaps a shot. Lana's back, studded with gold sand, her eyes closed, her blonde hair wet and glued to her cheek. The sun hovers like a red Chinese lantern over the wave breakers. She titles it, in her head, "My First Israeli Friend."
So she has high hopes for this.
Right? They had a shared experience out on the breakers.
They did, right? They did. And Lana is the kind of person that, you know, she just relates. She doesn't, you know, she's not scared, and she relates in such a genuine way. "Oh, I'm so sorry," you know, and then she gives her a hug. She's just, you want to say, you know, yeah, that's a wonderful, and so you can see why Lily's hopes are up. You know, they really have connected. Okay, so then Lily starts taking photographs of her for those, you know, so they start, and they start spending a long time together. So turn to...
there's one thing that I love about the story.
Yes.
It really is very positive about women and nuts.
What do you mean? You mean because of the father?
Yes. With the new family and Igor saying, "He thought you drowned."
right. It's yeah. Well, and there is that too. Although what we're going to find out about Lily is she, you know, there's some nascent homosexuality possibly growing here, which she's not aware of, right? She's okay.
Why is it homosexual?
No, I think she's becoming.
No,
you don't think she's 14.
I thought so too. Because I think intentionally so, because we'll see that the author talks about, you know, when she kisses her and there's this kind of rush of, you know, warm feeling and so on in her body and so on. I think she was trying to say that, you know, it's possible. Certainly Lily has not identified it yet, but there might be. Okay. We can disagree.
Yeah, right.
Page 37. "When I first moved here, I wanted to go back so badly," Lana says. "I cried every day, but you get used to it. Then you start to love it, and you don't want to leave." "But I don't want to get used to it," Lily wants to say. "Whatever," she says instead, stretching her arm to grab the photos, but Lana moves her hand again. So on the one hand, Lana is so, there's something so wonderful about her. "I cried every day." And we know that Lily is crying every day. So, you know, she's, in a sense, she's saying, you know,
It's okay.
You are not alone. Skip down to the bottom of the page. Have you ever even kissed someone?" Lana says. "No." It all happens fast. Lana perches herself on her elbows and plants a kiss on Lily's lips. Lily feels like a wave has just lifted her off her feet and dropped her back to the ground. Lana leans back on the mattress. "Well, now you have." Lily collects the photos, jumps off the bed, puts them back in the box, hides the box back in the closet. Her fingers are shaking. Her lips taste like lipstick, cherry gum, and wax. "Don't look so shocked," Lana laughs. "It's no big deal."
I think that this is a very positive kind of physicality between these two girls.
Yes.
I believe it's what your mom said. It's a positive view of women.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And it's her first kiss. What does it matter if you kiss a man or you kiss a woman? A kiss is a kiss. Lip on lip, right? I mean, it's first kiss. Okay, never mind. Maybe I went too far.
No. I mean,
well,
how
it
many?
It comes right after the description of Talia. Mm-hmm. Being a soldier and a sexy soldier and taking sexy pictures with your gun. This is what women are doing in Israel, ladies.
This is what women are doing in Israel, but
Well, they talk a bit about her being
a woman on a woman kiss. That doesn't strike you as, that strikes you as like completely natural?
Completely natural.
Okay.
For a teenager, yeah.
Weird.
Okay. Yeah. We will see. Maybe we can convince you otherwise. We'll see. Okay. 39. You shouldn't be hanging out with that girl so much, Talia says to Lily later that day as the two of them share watermelon slices in the kitchen. Her family is fucked. Lily looks up. What do you mean? They're messed up. Talia spits a seed onto the plate. Her dad is a drunk and her mom, people saw her walking around with Ellie from the grocery store. So, these Russian chicks, they come here and take all the men. Israeli men love blondes. The couple next door divorced, and 2 weeks later he moves in with some Natasha. Yeah. She's a pharmacist, Lily said, and they're not Russians, they're from Belarus. What? She's a pharmacist and he's an engineer. It's hard in this country. They can't find jobs and the language. Talia stares at Lily for a while and breaks into a grin. You love her. Little Arafat is in love. No, I'm not, Lily blushes, and she gets up and puts her plate in the sink, her face tingling. So what do we learn from this conversation between Talia and Lily?
Lily's trying to explain to her why Lana's situation is not the way it appears on the surface, that there's really more to it and that she should understand that.
Right.
And Talia's saying, well, you know, you're saying that, but, you know, you just are, you know, in love with her and you're really not seeing it for what it is.
Right. And there is, you know, we'll see it more later, I think, when in that last very touching scene where Aunt Ruthie is, you know, comforting her and she says she's not worth it and so on. But there's definitely this thing about Mizrahim and Russians going on there.
Mm-hmm.
And who is, you know, a higher status than who, and contributing to the fact that, oh, you shouldn't be talking to her. Families.
Right. They're messed up.
Right. And Lily can see more into it because she can relate to it.
And because she doesn't know that she's supposed to be...
Right. She doesn't know she should have, you know, she has prestige.
Yeah.
Okay, page 40. Oh, boy. Okay. Now, this is a very important conversation. Let's see. Barry, do you want to read?
I don't know if you'll enjoy my... stuffed up.
We will enjoy it. Just the top from Lana says. Top of 40.
Very first top line. If. Okay. Lana says, if you see someone looking suspicious, even if it seems silly or you're not sure, just tell me and we'll get off the bus. Better to be safe, you know? How can you tell if someone looks suspicious? Well, he has to look like an Arab. How can you tell? What do you mean? In Canada, people sometimes thought my mom was an Arab. Was she? Oh, no, but my grandparents came from Yemen, so we are Arabs in a way, Arab Jews. Lana laughs. No, that's impossible. You're either an Arab or a Jew. Yeah, but you're a Belarusian Jew. Why can't there be Arab Jews? I'm Israeli now, Lana says, and so are you.
So let's pause there for a second. So what's underneath this conversation between Lana and Lily?
Racism.
Okay, so, right. You know, if he looks Arab, he's suspicious.
Right. And fitting in also.
And Lily actually looks, you know, mm-hmm. Arab, you know, or at least by some people's mm-hmm. Estimation. And Lily says they're Arab Jews, and Lana says no, can't be. You can't be Arab and Jewish together, which is the whole point.
All right.
Right? This is the whole point. You can be Arab and Jewish together. Yes. Maybe you've never met one before, but and she says you're a Belarusian Jew. Why can't there be Arab Jews? I'm Israeli now, Lana says, and so are you.
Right.
We're just part of the Israeli melting pot.
But right? I see Israelis here, they look like Arabs too.
Yes, yes, as well they should, given, you know, they come from Arabic countries. But that's something very important here, which is in the immigrant experience. Do you keep your roots, or are you part of the great melting pot that is now Israeli society? You know, Lana says, the differences don't matter anymore because we're all Israeli. Yeah.
Except when we're not.
Except when we're not. Exactly. Except when it's us and them. Right? So, you know, Lana's giving voice to this, you know, but that's not how the reality works necessarily. And then this heartbreaking moment where she passes her father by and doesn't say hello to him. Ugh. Okay, and then Lana gives her a present. What was the present? The chamsa, right?
The stolen chamsa.
Well, we walked out without not buying anything, right? So yes, the stolen one. So 42. Lana pushes down Lily's baseball hat and laughs. She glances at the entrance to the mall, scans the parking lot, and says, "Go ahead, kiss me." "Here? People can see us." "Fuck them," Lana smirks. Lily leans forward. She has to angle her head so her cap won't get in the way. She touches her lips to Lana's, feels Lana's tongue pushing into her mouth. It tastes like strawberry frozen yogurt, which is what they've been eating, right? When they part, Lana says, "That was good. You're getting better at it." She walks toward the bus stop, swinging her ponytail from side to side. Lily feels her feet carried up by a wave. But this time she stays suspended, rocking on the surface of the water. Hello? Are these sexual feelings here? She can't believe she just kissed that girl in the blue dress and the high ponytail in the middle of this parking lot. For the next couple of days, Lily tastes strawberry frozen yogurt in everything. "Lily and Lana," she mouths to the orange striped sheets at night. "Lana and Lily," she whispers to the bugs crashing against her walls. But after 3 days of not seeing Lana, her feet hit the ground with a thump. So we're still not convinced. We still think this is all just... There you go. Okay. So page 40.
And I think it's that there's more emphasis on it now, Lonnie, where the adolescents are really overtly experimenting with homogeneous relationships and heterogeneous, and you're not one or the other. Yeah. I don't understand it very well, but it's there.
Right, right. But this is, you know, almost 30 years ago. So the whole spectrum of gender hasn't happened yet. I mean, I don't think so. 30 years ago. No, not. I'm talking about the trans and, you know, coming into parlance.
But I think experimentation among same-sex kids has always been happened. There for adolescents.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Right. And that seems to me, at least, to be the context of this.
Yeah.
But it would happen a little bit later. I remember seeing it when I was at Brandeis.
Right. I think it's displaced people. So it's kids in boarding school. It's kids in college.
Right.
Why it can't be the immigrants too, I don't know. Mm-hmm. But it seems that same sort of, we're alone. We don't know who we are. Are we Israelis? Mm-hmm. Are we Belarus? Yeah. Are we Canadian? Are we Israelis? I mean, it's this.
It is an experimentation.
I mean, yeah. It's an experimentation, and they don't have their feet on the ground.
Right, right.
And who she ends up being in the end, who knows? But
right, right. Okay, okay. So let's keep going. Page 43 is where she sees the scene of Lana's parents, and where Lana's father hits her. And now we understand a little bit more why she walked right past him, and she's so angry with him. The middle of the page, Lana looks at her hands bleeding from the shattered glass, and then up at the spectators, she sees Lily and Talia. They both duck. but she's already seen them, mm-hmm. right? When Lily looks out again, Lana is gone. A neighbor is talking to her father, a police siren in the background. The next day, Lily calls Lana from downstairs, but Lana doesn't come to the window. In the evening, she sees her from the balcony and quickly opens the shutters and calls her name. Lana hurries inside because
she's embarrassed.
Yeah. Okay, so let's read this last section. It's the last Friday of August, and school is just about to start. Early in the day, Ruthie took Lily to see her new school and walked her through the empty hallways. There were no lockers. Students carry their books from home, stay in the same classrooms for the entire day. School is different here, mm-hmm. a different country. Ruthie and Lily walk back from the bus stop carrying bags of books and school supplies when they see Lana leaning on a car across the street chewing gum. She's wearing her blue strapless dress and silvery sandals. She looks like she may be going to the beach without Lily. Lily pauses at the entrance. Go, Ruthie waves her on and takes the bags from Lily's hand and disappears into the dark stairwell. Lily crosses the street. Lana's mom heaves suitcases into the trunk of the car. Where are you going? Lily says. To stay with my aunt in Rishon for a while, Lana says. She doesn't look Lily in the eye. For how long? I don't know. What about school? Lana shrugs. Are you okay? Lily says. I've been worried about you. For the first time, Lana looks up at her. Lana's mom turns and says something in Russian, and Lana answers without looking at her, sounding annoyed. Her mom sighs and walks across the street and into the building. Lily pushes her hands into the pockets of her jeans and kicks the curb. I saw you, she says, the other day with Igor in the park. So, Lana says. So Lana's worried about the family thing, right? Mm-hmm. But what's on Lily's mind has nothing to do with the family thing. She understands that it's hard. Lily looks down at her shoes. So, Lana says, Lily looks down at her shoes. So nothing, Lily says. Oh my God, Lana says slowly, you're jealous. She starts laughing. That's so cute. Ugh. And Lily's dying 1,000 deaths, right? Mm-hmm. Lily doesn't remember walking away. She has to move fast because her tears are coming. She bumps into Lana's mom on the way, mumbles sorry in English, because she's totally disoriented, runs up the stairs but doesn't enter the apartment. She sits on a cool tiled stair in the dim stairwell and cries. The door opens and the sensor light above her turns on. Lily, Ruthie says, there you are, I was just going to get milk. Lily nods at the floor, wiping her tears with her forearm. Ruthie sits down beside her and searches her face. Are you okay? Despite herself, Lily bursts into tears again. Oh, sweetie, Ruthie pulls Lily to her and pats her head, rocking her lightly. She's no good, she says, that girl. Lily says nothing. She's heard it all from Talia. She doesn't need to hear it again. She recognizes that, you know, this is both the mother and the daughter. You can do a lot better, Ruthie says quietly, and this time Lily looks up. In her aunt's eyes, she sees warmth, recognition. Blood rushes to her cheeks. She buries her face in Ruthie's shirt, breathing in the scent of coffee and spices. They sit on the step for a while without talking. Sometimes the light turns on and then clicks off, leaving them in darkness. Sometimes people squeeze past them, going up or down the stairs. They hear muffled laughter behind closed doors, a scooter speeding off down the street. Evening shadows sneak into the stairway, the smells of dinner and cigarette smoke. Lily doesn't move. It's okay, Ruthie says. It's okay.
Was anyone else like emotional?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, Ruthie gets it.
Mm-hmm. She validates her.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And what's happened with Lana has allowed, you know, Lily's been keeping the crying to herself, and I don't know if they were just not intruding or whether they didn't hear, but this has finally allowed her to start crying, which is great. Mm-hmm. And then Ruthie can, you know, and she looks into her eyes, and they are, it's a different relationship now.
You know, her writing is very universal. Because this type of situation is real, it was real, and in her stories, there's a universality about what she's writing. Things could happen the same way in all of these stories.
Yes.
So it's not just an Israeli story.
Yes.
It's
It's a universal story. And that's what she says. She wants to write about truth with a small t. Because this is a human story.
Right.
It's placed in Israel. It has to do with, you know, immigrant groups that are specific to Israel. But because she so skillfully writes this very particular story, it can be universal.
But when the Jews came to the States, and in Brooklyn?
Yes.
And they had the push carts. It was the same thing. There were all kinds of Jews.
Yes.
And I'm sure there were the same interactions and the pecking order and
yes.
so on.
Yes,
mm-hmm.
yes.
But it's this vision that she creates of the light clicking on mm-hmm. and the light clicking off
yeah.
and people squeezing by. But this time what we hear from the apartments is laughter. Mm-hmm. Okay. And so she gives us this positive picture of life moving on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And everybody understanding what's happening on the stairs, so they don't interrupt.
Mm-hmm. Or yell at them.
Or yell at them. I mean, this is an immigrant community. They've seen this over and over and over and over.
Yeah.
And they know that who Ruthie is, and they know who Lily is. And they respect that.
Right.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's really very pretty.
Yes, mm-hmm. yes. And that last paragraph where life just goes on, mm-hmm. right? Something like mm-hmm. catastrophic has happened in Lily's life, right? Or, you know, this friend isn't going to be there. She's not going to know anybody in high school when she gets there and so on. Mm-hmm. Life goes on. People move past them. They hear the traffic and so on. But she has her aunt, you know.
Represents
right.
getting out of
represents right. stability.
Stability, right. her Love. Mother's sister.
Somebody who cares about her.
Somebody who cares about her. Yeah. So it's the ending is very, you know, it's hopeful. Mm-hmm. It's hopeful.
Actually, it's interesting. When I was reading it what it made me think of was the tours that they give in the Tenement Museum in New York.
Oh, yes.
It's very much that same kind of, it's very much that same story.
Right. And when I look out my window where I live now, across the street is a house, and they have a light that goes on and off. So I don't know, there's nobody walking by to get the light to go on, it just,
right, and one other thing that she includes here, you know, when you this theme of displacement that comes through all of the stories, it also is an opportunity for reinvention, right? And so she might be able to be not the social outcast that she was in Canada. So, you know, there are also possibilities. There's a lot of pain, but there's also mm-hmm. possibilities.
I never thought of that because Ruthie is so middle class. She out-middle classes the middle class in her stroking of Lily and in her sitting on the step and understanding her. I'm saying, where'd she get it from? She's living in this place, but it takes one person in that kind of environment to lift.
Mm. Yes.
She says, you can do better than that, she understands Lily's feelings.
Mm-hmm. Yes. 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 Yes, absolutely.
Yes.
And it's no big deal. It's just.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she's, unlike her daughter, she's not really questioning it so much. She's much more validating than she is, you know, criticizing.
And she can be supportive.
Right.
Well, she's a generation ahead.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right. No, that's exactly why. Yeah.
She has life experiences that allow her.
Yeah, very, very. Yeah.
Ah, I love it.
Yeah. Okay. Good. Excellent.
The next one's even better.
Oh, the next one's even really good, too.
Yeah. But I still have a question about somebody.
This is my favorite thing.